It's time for Sound Mind with life coach and counselor Daniel Pryor. For more information about Daniel Pryor and his services, visit BibleBasedCounselor.com. Daniel has offices in Kirkland and Edmonds. And now your host, Daniel Pryor.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, the Sound Mind broadcast with Daniel Pryor once again this week, tackling a difficult subject we started last week, and that is the issue of suicide. Suicide so much in the news lately. A lot of famous people, rich people seem to have everything to live for, killing themselves. But a more closer to home issue is the issue of teen suicide. And Daniel, you want to address this alarming trend.
I can't think of anything more tragic for a parent than having a child commit suicide, and anything more fearful, really, than having a child that's so depressed that they're acting out in that way. A lot of kids, I think, will do what is being termed parasuicide, which is basically a self-harm behavior, and kids go through this stage. And we want to talk a little bit about today about why they go through it. Now, Grant, this is such a huge topic. I'm gonna do my best to present a lot here, but it's still just scratching the surface. And there are big books written about this topic, but there are some things that maybe parents should know. And let's try to get as far as we can in this. So I mentioned parasuicide, and parasuicide, and so a lot of parents will be concerned about their child talking about suicide, maybe even some kids cutting themselves. And so some of this is like it's superficial, but it's concerning. And the thing is that the more parasuicide you see, the more the chances that suicide will occur. If only that the parasuicide behaviors goes wrong one time. And then I was hearing the other day a testimony of a man who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, young man, and survived, one of very few that has ever survived that. And, he said his thoughts when he just went over the rail, he said, it's the same thing that everybody that's ever survived said. A second after he let go of the rail, he had the deepest regret. It just seems that things come into perspective. And I would guess that that's probably the experience of everyone who commits suicide. As soon as they're past the point of no return, there's instant regret. But we're going to talk today a lot about suicide. And parasuicide is part of that, escalating with the teens, and primarily this idea of social media, because this is really something to keep our eye on. Social media doesn't affect adults the way it affects teenagers.
Yeah, this is a new phenomenon.
Adults handle it different, and we're going to talk about why they do. Escalating teen suicide indicates a number of things. One, the stuff that we've always had, like children growing up, feeling unloved, being abandoned.
Again, the human condition. Yeah.
And I think probably the whole abortion thing plays a strong card in there.
Absolutely.
Because,
death culture.
Yeah, it's a death culture. Mm-hmm. And so, again, and the second thing is that this present, recent and current fixation on death and hopelessness, kind of the Nietzsche embrace the abyss. You know, there's no meaning in life, just embrace it and, have courage. And then one in particular is that we've grown at least one generation of detached people. Suicide is a detachment from a broader reality, to state it simply. The escalation in teen suicide and parasuicide has been linked to escalation in the use of smartphones and social media. So talk a little bit about that. The escalation really began, track these really quick. I'm going to look ahead. Facebook started in 2004, and it currently has 1.45 billion daily attendance. Twitter started in 2006, and it's 316 million strong currently. And Snapchat started in 2012, and it's 160 million current. Now, those are the three main venues, and when we talk about social media and the danger of social media, it's those three more than others. It's Facebook, Twitter and Snapchat. We'll talk about those a bit later. So it started about, 2004 for Facebook. That's when it started to escalate. It really took off in 2006 with Twix. But Snapchat has escalated it
now,
exponentially.
So tell me, why is this medium affecting suicide so much in teenagers? What is the nut?
Okay.
What is the main reason, do you think? What is social media? Because it's not obvious. Why would social media be causing suicide?
Yeah, and remember some of the things we talked about last week, and we'll refresh this week. Mm-hmm. Remember the three things that are fun, that are kind of concurrent with that is tunnel vision. That is the what I see as reality is the only reality. Mm-hmm. So I have that very tunnel vision.
That's a big part of social media.
Okay, so that's a big part of it. So if someone in their reality feels they've been told they're hopeless, well, that's the only reality. They don't look outside beyond that. The other one is a lack of an ultimate hope, something beyond themselves. And then the third one was?
The narrow egocentric reality and isolation.
And isolation, right.
Okay.
Now, you say, well, I would think not isolation.
Social means I'm not isolated.
Yeah.
I'm connected to people, but it's actually very isolated.
Well, what they're isolated from is they're isolated from their parents, and they're isolated from people who can bring them a broader view of reality.
I see. Okay.
So their relationships all concur and affirm this very narrow view of reality, them and us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more amongst girls than boys, and I'll just make a comment here. Do boys react in some other equally violent way? So I want to suggest here that suicide is hatred toward myself and punishing myself for the message that I'm getting. There's a way that I can punish other people, and I would suggest that the shootings we see in school is just the other side, the tail side of the heads, where these are people who are responding to the same things that the suicide victims are responding to, but instead of hating themselves, they're hating the hatred is turned out toward others. Just let that set there, more so among girls than boys, but then we have that. So teens have for a long time been the higher risk, and that is because of the following. Now, as adults, we have a broader range of life experience, and we can weigh that of the value of other people's opinion against our broader experience.
Because we weren't raised with this social media, so this is a very unique phenomenon going on with young people today.
We weren't raised with the social media. Communities were stronger, and we've just got more miles on the odometer. Mm-hmm. We've seen that, the sun will come up tomorrow.
Right.
Okay. Teens lack the then and now, They lack the this too will pass perspective in their young lives. And so they've only known, home and the school environment. And when you think of a child who is 18, has been in school, it would be like me, if I'm 100 years old, having the same job for 75 or 80 years.
Okay,
so this is their perspective. They have been in school and at home their entire life, or pretty much their entire life. And that's the scope of their reality. They are unable to look beyond that. And so at home, they struggle to find sort of a unique, stable identity, autonomy, and freedom in a home that really belongs to their parents. You know, the furniture is my parents, the home is my parents, and so I follow their rules. Who they are as individuals at home isn't really clear. That's why a lot of sibling rivalry. It's kids trying to figure out who they are at home. At school, they seek identity in the opinions of their peers because school has been their entire life experience, and they lack the objective that I just mentioned, that the far greater portion of life lies beyond school years. They feel that the opinion of their peers is the final word. So they're trapped in this perspective. It's very much this closed-off view of reality is very much akin to that persuasion that accompanies the tattoo madness, and that is my opinions or my impressions of myself, age 13 through 20. That's who I am. That's who I'll always be. Nothing in life could ever change that. Others' impressions of me will never change. I've seen all that life has to offer, and I've come to the conclusions, to certain conclusions that can never change. That's their perspective. So, so all of their marbles are in this one bag, and they reach out. Social media comes to them, and especially this Facebook people be unfriending or
bullying, on
bullying, and particularly in this Snapchat. If you know what Snapchat is, it's you send a message and a message and a photograph, and it can be any kind of photograph. So you can see to a person, and then as soon as they open it, it's just there for a second, and then it disintegrates. So it could be bullying, it could be any kind of message, derogatory, anything. It could be pornography, it could be anything, So this is what captivates them. Mm-hmm. Smartphone and social media changing the game. There's a author, Twenge, I think is her name, Miss Twenge, wrote this article, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious and More Tolerant, but Less Happy and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. You could do a show on each one of those, but I would suggest that they're less rebellious because the parents are absent. And there aren't as many rules being enforced.
Right. Nothing to rebel against.
Man. Yeah. And they're more tolerant because they don't know what they believe. They don't have to take a stand on anything. And that's why they're less happy and completely unprepared for adulthood. Mm-hmm. What does the phone do for children? So what does the phone do for young people to begin with? Well, I think it gives them a sense of autonomy, freedom. They connect with their peer group. But they're isolated and insulated from their parents and the adult world. And that is, the adult world is confusing, controlling, demanding, unappreciative, misunderstanding. And I guess to be fair, many parents have failed to persuade the young people to the contrary. Downsides of the smartphone, maybe we should do this when we come back, and I'll get into this when we come back. But the downside of the smartphones, we want to consider how our brain processes the messages that come through these instant media, because it's very much the way they process addictions and anger. So we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back, and some other goodies.
Okay, well, it's an interesting subject. We're concerned that teen suicide is on the rise in our culture, and we want to combat that, want to prevent it. And if you have a teen in your life, Daniel can help you. He helps families a lot. And Daniel, how do people get in touch with you?
Yes, you can call me at 425-778-6169, 425-778-6169. Office is in Kirkland and Edmonds. And people also email me through website, BibleBasedCounselor.com.
Okay, back with more of the Sound Mind broadcast in just a moment.
Hi, this is Daniel Pryor with a word regarding the many faces of anger. The key to managing anger is to recognize it when it doesn't look like anger. Otherwise, we find ourselves resisting anger when it wears one face, but then embracing it when it wears another. From personal experience and professional training, I understand this. I can help you recognize the faces of anger and teach you tools of effective management. Contact me through my website, BibleBasedCounselor.com, or call 425-778-6169.
Sound Mind with life coach and counselor Daniel Pryor. And now your host, Daniel Pryor.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, looking at the tough subject of teen suicide this week on the program. And during the break, we were talking about this program, 13 Reasons Why, a Netflix show that, in my opinion, has helped to increase teen suicide. A lot of people think, no, it's a great way to discuss it because it's a subject nobody wants to talk about. But kids are so impressionable. And the whole idea presented in that show is that suicide is a solution. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of why people, they see suicide as a solution. But then you mentioned in our previous segment that first thing people feel like when they've tried to commit suicide, if they were able to come back, was a sense of regret. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, this was not the answer. Yeah. So yeah, it's just a big lie.
Yeah, this isn't the answer. Another thing that this fellow was saying was that people aren't going to know why I did this. They're not going to...
Well, and that's the contrivance in this show is she leaves behind these tapes that say, I'm taking myself out, and this is why.
Yeah, and
you did me bad, you did me bad, you did me bad.
And the deception there is that the sense that she's still around delivering that message, but she's gone. The tapes
are
there.
So she's punishing people from the grave.
Yeah.
And so that's, again, an insidious kind of evil idea that is that kids are latching onto.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if the increase in teen suicide is directly related to that show, you know,
could
which
be.
Is, who knows if you can really prove that. But again, this idea of suicide, self-harm being an answer is where kids are going. They have no experience.
The answer to what? And and there's where the problem lies, is that it's the answer to a question that mankind wasn't, intended to live that way. That, you know, the real question is, has to do with God, that purpose, the ultimate purpose in life, not why is there misery and why are there no answers, why are there no solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about just the fundamentals of the phone itself and how our brain processes it. You know, first, you know, consider the brain function, how the brain functions around the smartphone usage. And, you know, when you're, particularly for teenagers, you don't usually put a lot of thought into smartphone correspondence. Texting is worse. So for most people, most of the phone time utilization utilizes areas of the brain that do not process deliberately, contemplatively. They're not very particularly objective. And so
just emotions.
So what areas are being utilized? Well, it's the same areas of that process pain and pleasure, fight or flight. These are areas that respond to threatening or rewarding stimuli. And a lot of the time, that's the hippocampus and the amygdala. And, of course, the amygdala participates in addiction. So we have a situation where we have a smartphone use, rather than being deliberate, objective, and contemplating, is responsive, very emotionally charged, and easily addictive. So the phone itself and the use of it is a setup. Now, I want to read off quickly a list of things. Now, these are things that they say contribute to the suicide, but I read them as just things that are just comorbidity or other solutions that people have come up to with the same stressors. They're not quite, they haven't quite concluded that suicide is the ultimate answer. These are other answers that they've come up with. Eating disorders, drug abuse, sexual abuse, I guess what's saying here is that the suicide is a response to sexual abuse and rape, divorce of parents, trauma, financial problems, bullying, social rejection, of course, anger, relationship breakups, and a couple more. Now, if we took each one of these and made a list of what things are represented by each one of these, I'll just take eating disorders. And these are things that are characteristic of kind of the mind frame of people with eating disorders would be a lot of these. Anger, fear, shame, lack of acceptance, comparing with others, preoccupation with appearance and acceptance, lack of objective purpose, lack of confidence, self-centered, lack of empathy, shared reality and shared boundaries, sense of helplessness, lack of control, lack of worth, lack of patience, planning toward a meaningful goal, lack of achievement, lack of perspective, lack of meaningful relationships. If you did drug abuse, you'd have a list very similar: anger, fear, shame, sense of hopelessness, self-centeredness, lack of self-acceptance, lack of patience, lack of meaningful relationships, and on and on. So you would take each one of those and you would find that there are these certain similarities in all of those. So this is the mindset of the person, the teenager, who is these are the mindset of a lot of teenagers anyway.
Right.
Anger, fear, shame, lack of confidence.
Sounds pretty familiar.
And so you take that cocktail, if you will, or that mix, and you put it into a media kind of like this experience of kind of media messaging, quick media messaging. You're getting hate messages you're getting on Facebook. You're getting people who are narcissistic. They're talking about all the great things, the things that are great about them and the things that are not so great about other people. So you take those and you put them together, and you have you're creating some kind of an emotional bomb. And this is why suicide is correlated with overuse of social media. The very attitudes and perceptions that accompany thoughts of suicide are indicated and encouraged in the overuse of social media. Mm-hmm. Now, we read off the social media, the main offenders here, Facebook, Twitter, and then Snapchat. And again, you know, consider these convergent realities. The teens' world perspective is narrow, egocentric. He or she is the center of meaning. What he or she believes is true is necessarily true. The peer group speaks for the gods, in a sense. How the peer group perceives me is what is true about me, and it will never change. So that perception is all important. A teenager's response to social media messaging utilizes areas of the brain that are associated with anger, addiction, subjective impulsivity. Limited use is fare better, because they say that if a child uses a smartphone less than 2 hours a day, they avoid all this. If they use it more than five, they're very, very high risk. Well, the less use shows restraint, discipline, self-control, a broader view of reality, objectivity, ability to compartmentalize and organize, to put off gratification in the interest of more important objectives, more properly judge the benefits and the values of others' opinions. Those are all really good things,
That's
not a complete list.
And that sounds like, so the number one thing, as we move into a little bit of suicide prevention with teenagers, number one thing is turn the phone off or take away that phone, or very limited use of phone.
Yeah,
number one.
And of course they don't want that. And so now here we come to the difficult part, and it's the prevention part, because they're short of putting your child in a padded cell with a lock and passing food through a slot. There's a point at which it can be frightening, and our kids are out there in an environment where we've talked a little bit about it earlier in the show, where there's an infatuation with death and the whole hopelessness thing, and it's because we've turned our backs on God. Mm. Now, Christian families struggle with these things too, and so I want to suggest some of the things that parents can do, and this is not an exhaustive list. Certainly, one of the things you want to pay attention to are these three things that we've talked about in the previous show and this show: the tunnel vision, what can you do in your child's life to get them out of this tunnel vision. Now, why are they in the tunnel vision? Well, because they've been in the same environment for their entire life. They have not got the perspective of someone who's been outside of that. Mm-hmm. If they can get past 20,
right,
get out of school, get past 20, the suicide rate drops off.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they don't have that perspective yet. Their friends and their friends' opinions, or their peers and their peers' opinion, are all meaningful to them. It's the voice of the gods. So they believe it. So what can you do in your child's life to expose them to a broader perspective? Are there families that you can be befriend, that you can be in the church, that you can participate with, where the kids get some cross pollinization with other kids and other families? Some parents take their kids on a missionary trip.
I was going to say, a missions trip.
Open up your perspective to how other people live and what values are in other places. Parents, you should model in your own life what you want your child to do. That's where it begins. You will not pass on the values you wish you had, only the values you have. And so you have to model
in
your life.
And kids want that. They want that from their parents more than anyone.
They do. And it's very confusing when they're getting mixed messages where, you know, it seems good for us, but dad and mom don't have to do it. Mm. You know, dad and mom want the kids to be happy, but the mom and dad aren't happy. They're worried about finances and this and that, and telling the kids, don't worry, God will provide, but then they're not practiced. You have to model what you want in your child's life. Communicate value to your child, not just in words, but in actions. It has to be real. And in order to make it real, your appreciation of the value of your child, it may require a good deal of self-reflection and prayer, because I notice that a lot of parents truly are not focusing on their children. The parents are themselves children, and the children have become their chums.
Mm-hmm.
But the parents are not entirely, not really parenting. They're not the strong ones.
His big friend.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So communicate the value of your child, and through a lot of times through a lot of prayer. And while I'm on prayer, I'll say, part of, I think, why our kids are going through this and the benefit that we can get through that from it is we have to learn to pray. The church doesn't know how to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let your child isolate and withdraw. Model and encourage proactivity in relationships. Keep them involved in the community and at church. And again, maybe something like a mission trip or something like that. Spend one-on-one time with your child whenever you can, and be careful to remain the parent, not a chum. And I have one more, and it's listen, listen, listen. always talking, over-explaining, that doesn't encourage your child to engage. As your child gets older, they need to practice talking to you, and I see it so much, and it's probably even a fault of my own, to over-explain.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the child just glass over when I'm in a session with the family, and parents are explaining things, and they get to a point where it's kind of been said, and they're trying to explain it differently because maybe it'll sink in better. And at that point, they're going backwards
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, listen, listen to your child. By the time they're in their teens, they probably know a lot more about what you think than you know about what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, as parents, we've mm-hmm. been telling them what we think
mm-hmm.
for all those years.
Listen, listen, listen. If you want to have some help listening, he will listen to what's going on in your family's life and help life coach and counselor Daniel Pryor. If people need to get a hold of you, Daniel, how do they do that?
Yes, you can call me at 425-778-6169, 425-778-6169. Offices in Kirkland and Edmonds. People also email me through the website, BibleBasedCounselor.com, and this show will be at the podcast at BibleBasedCounselor.com.
Many podcasts. There are many, several years of podcasts there at BibleBasedCounselor.com. Always great stuff. The Sound Mind broadcast with life coach and counselor Daniel Pryor on KCIS.
You've been listening to Sound Mind with life coach and counselor Daniel Pryor. For more information about Daniel Pryor and his services, visit BibleBasedCounselor.com. Daniel has offices in Kirkland and Edmonds. To make an appointment, call 425-778-6169. Be sure to tune in each Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. for Sound Mind with Daniel Pryor.